From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, a tale of two regions. We begin in the region long known in the U.S. as its backyard, Latin America, the only region in the world where the gap between rich and poor is actually narrowing. That, according to Nora Lustig, a Latin American economics professor at Tulane University. The trend has been holding steady for the past 15 years. U.S. dominance over Latin America has been on the decline, and there's been a rise of an independent political, social, and economic bloc whose beginnings can be traced to the election of Hugo Chavez in 1998. She writes that inequality in Latin America has unambiguously and steadily declined in the decade and a half after the year 2000. The so-called Gini coefficient, the most commonly used measure of inequality, fell in 16 of the 17 countries where there are comparable data, and the change was statistically significant for all of them. She reported that existing studies point to two main explanations for the decline in inequality: a reduction in hourly labor income inequality, and more robust and progressive government tax and fiscal policies, adding that the available evidence suggests it's the skill premium, or more precisely, the returns to primary, secondary, and tertiary education versus no schooling or incomplete primary schooling that's been driving the decline in hourly labor income inequality. Meanwhile, those who are on the receiving end of U.S. attention these days report effects that are quite different from those being experienced in Latin America. Escalating conflict and political upheaval across the Middle East and North Africa are preventing 13 million children from going to school. That, according to a new report by the UN Children's Agency, UNICEF. That report, entitled Education Under Fire, focuses on the impact of violence on children and schools in 9 countries suffering protracted conflict. The wars and consequent unrest have also driven massive numbers of refugees out of their own communities, with millions escaping to other places within the region and hundreds of thousands in or headed to Europe. Deanne Penn has more.
Global shock over heartbreaking images of child refugees in Europe must be matched by action. That statement comes from Anthony Lake, head of the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, who's calling for measures to protect migrant and refugee children. This includes providing essential services such as health care, food, education, and emotional support. Children comprise at least a quarter of all asylum seekers in Europe, according to UNICEF. Mr. Lake said, as debates over asylum continue, we must never lose sight of the deeply human nature of this crisis, nor of the children. Deanne Penn, United Nations.
The chief of the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, Antonio Guterres, said Friday that huge new asylum processing centers are a part of the answer to the spike in the number of desperate women and children fleeing the conflicts and arriving on the EU's borders. An estimated 200,000 people need shelter in Europe, according to UNHCR, which urged EU member states to do more to help refugees who believed they had been misled by authorities. Daniel Johnson reports.
The UN refugee agency's call for huge new reception centres in Italy, Greece and Hungary amounts to a radical overhaul of European Union asylum policy. Speaking in Geneva, UNHCR spokesperson Melissa Fleming said this would prevent people smugglers from exploiting desperate refugees who felt they had been misled by the authorities.
There's a lot of fear among refugees. They feel that they've been misled. They don't know what's going to happen to them. By not having these processing centers in place, you're basically handing over easy profits to smugglers.
The development comes as EU leaders continue to deliberate about how to help hundreds of thousands of refugees fleeing conflict zones, principally in Syria, but also from neighboring countries where conditions have become intolerable. Pressure for a solution to the crisis has mounted in recent days after pictures were published of Aylan, a 3-year-old refugee who died trying to cross the Mediterranean. In a call for action from the EU, UNHCR chief Antonio Guterres said that while Aylan's story had touched the hearts of many, 2,600 people have died trying to cross the Mediterranean Sea already this year. Daniel Johnson, United Nations, Geneva.
Moving back to Latin America, just days before the country's elections, which are set for Sunday, Guatemala's president changed residences, moving from the presidential palace to a prison cell, where he's awaiting trial for charges of corruption. The announcement of the resignation of former President Otto Perez Molina was followed immediately after with the swearing-in of his successor, former Vice President Alejandro Maldonado. The new president, in turn, immediately asked all cabinet members and other top government officials to hand in their resignations and announced he would name all new ministers. Regarding Sunday's election, we begin with this report from Deanne Penn.
The UN Secretary General has appealed to authorities and all sectors in Guatemala to work together to strengthen institutions and rule of law. Ban Ki-moon's comments came in a statement on Thursday following the resignation of President Otto Perez Molina. Mr. Ban said he trusts the authorities will abide by the Constitution and ensure an orderly democratic transition. The UN chief also called on all Guatemalans to ensure that upcoming elections are held in a peaceful environment. Nine teams from the UN Human Rights Office, OHCHR, in Guatemala will be monitoring this weekend's elections. Alberto Brunori is the OHCHR representative for the country.
We will try to have a deployment in order to prevent forms of violence or conflicts that unfortunately have happened repeatedly in the country. We will accompany the National Human Rights Institution, the Ombudsman Office, in its deployment, and certainly we will coordinate with the electoral mission of the Organization of the American States, and hopefully we will have a Sunday without violence.
Deanne Penn, United Nations.
And for more on the situation in Guatemala, we spoke with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, via Skype from Managua, Nicaragua, Friday.
I want to play a little clip first about Guatemala, which we can use to jump into this. This is from the State Department yesterday, I think, and via Telesur. So we're going to go to that first.
At a White House briefing, spokesman Josh Earnest said the United States respects Perez Molina's decision to resign and commends the Guatemalan people for the manner in which they have dealt with the crisis.
The United States will continue to support Guatemala's democratic process, including peaceful general elections that are scheduled for September 6th. We also continue to support Guatemalan efforts to fight corruption and impunity in Guatemala, including the work done by the Public Ministry and the International Commission Against Impunity in Guatemala.
Okay, so you heard that, right?
Yeah, and it's very curious, the whole situation there in Guatemala. And I haven't been following it that closely, and it's obviously very quickly come to a head. And I think even a couple of months ago, Perez Molina himself will have thought that he could ride out the storm, as it were.
Yeah, maybe you could give us a quick outline of what's just the, you know, the events that have happened, like a quick timeline, ballpark.
Yeah, and how far back should we go? Should we go back to 1954? You know, and
you could start with our bed. Yeah, right.
Yeah, and the Guatemala's history through the 20th century has been, in some ways, very similar to the tragic history of the other countries in the region. And throughout the 20th century, it was very much under the thumb of the U.S. multinational interests, in particular the United Fruit Company. And prior to the Second World War, it came under the control of a military man, Ubico. I think it was Jorge Ubico, I can't remember his first name, and who was one of the dictators at the time that was supported by the Roosevelt administration all through the so-called good neighbor policy. That was how the United States under Roosevelt characterized its foreign policy in the Latin American and Caribbean region. They characterized United States policy towards its regional neighbors as that of the good neighbor. The good neighbor consisted of sustaining in Central America. Dictators like Anastasio Somoza, Ubico, Carlos Andino in Honduras, Maximo Rodriguez in El Salvador, who was responsible for a terrible, notorious massacre there.
with neighbors like
And that enduring, all those people were very closely linked to U.S. corporate interests at the time. And then after the Second World War, it became an embarrassment to have all these dictators in power for the United States. And so one way or another, kind of slight democratic openings happened. And in Guatemala, that led to the government of Jacobo Arbenz, who was a kind of, I suppose he'd be characterized as a social democrat, certainly in Western European political terms.
Right.
And he engaged in what was a very moderate land reform and a very moderate brand of nationalism that slightly affected the interests of the United Fruit Company. And the United Fruit Company, and it's backed by the U.S. government, reacted very aggressively to this attempt at some kind of opening up of national space and opening up a democratic space.
Let me describe, in Guatemala. Give me a second to describe that here. What we're talking about that Arbenz was trying to do, United Fruit owned, I forget, more than half the land in Guatemala. Huge proportion.
Yeah, and certainly the best agricultural land.
Yes, and what Arbenz was intending to do, what he was trying to establish as a policy, was to take the land that they weren't using and weren't planning to use, just the stuff they had basically in a land bank, and pay them for it retail. Then they wanted an exorbitant price, and he used the number that they were using to calculate their taxes as the number for decades prior, and said, I'll pay you exactly what you've been claiming that it is for the land. And that is what brought about what you're going to describe now.
Yes, and you know more about Guatemala than I do. And the subsequent to that attempt at opening up Guatemala's economy to Guatemala's national interest, and for that crime, the United States government backed a military coup that was supported by neighboring dictators like Anastasio Somoza. And that threw out of power the Arbenz government, brought into power a government more to the liking of United Fruit on their payroll. Mm. And that instituted a long period of authoritarian rule. And then through the 70s, there was a growing resistance to especially among indigenous people in Guatemala, to the status quo that broke out into open warfare all through the 80s. And that was the period when General Rios Montt, who's been in the news recently, successfully evading court procedures as a result of alleged dementia. But back then in the mid-80s, Rios Montt was a general who was responsible for massive incidents of genocide against indigenous people in Guatemala.
Yes.
And something in Guatemala itself through the 70s and 80s, and some estimates put the number of people killed by the army, or people killed as a result of the war, at well over 200,000. That's in Guatemala's population now is about 15 million.
Okay.
And so and back then it was probably around 11 or 12. So 200,000 people massacred at that time. It was a massive campaign of extermination by the army against the guerrillas in Guatemala. And so then through the 90s, Guatemala recovered as part of the regional peace process. Its economy became one of the most successful economies, certainly in GDP terms, but not in terms of equality. It was in fact President Benicio Cerezo back in the late 80s who made the whole peace process in the region possible, and he deserves all credit for that. And he's a center-right politician, but he deserves all the credit for promoting the peace process that made possible peace in the region, particularly peace in Nicaragua.
Right.
And Daniel Ortega, whenever he discusses the matter, always makes a point of stating that it's Vinicio Cerezo rather than Oscar Arias, the Costa Rican Nobel Prize winner. It's Vinicio Cerezo who deserves credit for that tremendous effort to bring peace to Central America. very much against the wishes at the time of the U.S. government, it has to be said.
I have to say, like Dos Santos is doing in Colombia right now.
Right. And so perhaps we can talk about that a little later. But just to kind of get up to date with Guatemala and what's happened in recent years is that Guatemala has had quite a lot of political instability under Alvaro Colom, the previous president. Alvaro Colom, who is also a center-right kind of politician, who very much promoted Central American integration. He suffered a similar kind of attack against his position, very, very much coming from the right wing, who they tried to involve him in scandals of all kinds. And so that's why, and I personally found it difficult to begin with to take seriously what was happening in the maneuvers around the attacks on Otto Perez Molina because of the experience with Alvaro Colom in just, what are we talking about, 5 or 6 years ago. And so this kind of political instability in Guatemala, it's difficult for people outside the country to get a hold on it, because it's not like the movement from below that you got in Honduras following the 2009 coup, where a grassroots movement with significant support of around 30% of the population struggled to reinstate democracy. And what's happened to Otto Perez Molina is much more like internal political infighting,
right,
around which part of the center-right elite is going to have power.
Right, it's not ideological, right? It's over quote-unquote corruption rather than an ideological difference, at least in terms of the public discourse.
Yeah, one of the things that I found interesting following it is the role of this UN Committee Against Impunity that was set up around 8 years ago. Mm. I think originally it was trying to deal with the legacy of the terrible legacy of the years of the 1980s, and then it kind of morphed into dealing with stuff more contemporary issues, right, to do like corruption,
right.
And that body has been very much supported by the United States, and it's a body that's quite controversial in Guatemala, because it was set up under the auspices of the UN, as I understand it. I might be wrong about that, but I'm pretty sure it was set up under the auspices of the UN about 8 years ago to try and bring stability and to, I suppose one word that one might use is closure to Guatemalan society about past events, and it got caught up in contemporary events. And it's a body with a strange status. It's able to intervene in Guatemala's internal affairs and take decisions that very much affect Guatemala's internal affairs. But it's not a democratic body.
Right.
It's not accountable to anybody.
Right. Oh, you can bet it's accountable to somebody in some back room somewhere.
Well, certainly not. It's certainly not accountable to the Guatemalan people, as
right.
such. And that's one of the characteristics that commentators on the recent events over the last month or so, or no, over the last week or so, have been commenting on. And another thing that commentators have been noting is the way that the United States has blatantly intervened in Guatemala's internal affairs. You know, making judgments about what should happen in the country. Where, you know, it reminds me so much of what used to happen in Nicaragua in the days of the neoliberal governments, for example, back in the 2001 elections. The then ambassador Oliver Garza and actively, openly, blatantly went out on the campaign trail with the party then in government on campaigning for the election of that candidate at that time. It was Enrique Bolaño,
right.
And on the night of the election, Christians, socialist politician Agustín Harkin, who had some role in the in the electoral process back then. He reported to the national press how Garza marched into the count centre and told the electoral authority that he wanted the people doing the count changed. No, that is fact. That is not, wow. You know, that's not some interpretation. That is the testimony of a centre-right politician.
You know,
very well respected.
So this break that's taking place within the centre-right of the political elite there, even though it's not taking an ideological form, appears to be breaking down along one particular ideological point, and that is the sovereignty of the value of the sovereignty of the nation, or the role of the nation as either vassal to the United States or as a sovereign country.
Yeah, and for people outside Guatemala, it's hard to find out what really is going on, and because I'm so cynical and skeptical about kind of U.S. versions, official U.S. versions of what's going on, it's almost as though they had something against Otto Perez Molina, perhaps for the same reason that they were happy to see the destabilization of Álvaro Colom. And in Álvaro Colom's case, Álvaro Colom was probably regarded by the United States government as too sympathetic to Central American integration and the whole idea that Central America should develop its own policies and become a united bloc with its own, following its own interests.
Yep.
No, rather than submitting itself to the U.S. policy like Plan Merida.
Let me speak to that for a minute. There's something very interesting at the UN website today, and I haven't been able to get the sound for it. I don't know if it's not loaded yet or if somebody's blocking it. But there's Nora Lustig, who's a Latin American economics professor at Tulane University here, has produced a study with some other economists. They've been looking at income inequality throughout Latin America. And they found that it's the only region of the world where the gap is actually narrowing. And this piece says that they're still unclear about specifically what's behind the trend, and spoke with Bruce Edwards from the IMF about the findings. But it's exactly correlating to the success of the economic integration of the region and the assertion of sovereignty as against the United States in terms of economic policy.
Yeah, and it's not just economic policy; it's social policy too.
That's right.
The Minister for National Policy here in Nicaragua gave a presentation the other day about stability in the region, and he was saying that of all the thousands of tens of thousands of children arriving at the U.S. frontier, the vast majority are from Guatemala and Honduras and El Salvador. And of all those many, many thousands, a total of 178 were from Nicaragua.
178 people, not 178,000.
Children. 178 children. And so what does that tell you about relative stability and the social conflict and the effects of organized crime and all that stuff? And it's just the United States has promoted policies throughout what's called the kind of Northern Triangle in Central America, which consists of El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala, that have generated massive instability. And their support for the coup in Honduras in particular has kind of worsens the already existing instability that the previous government that was thrown out, Mel Zelaya, had actually done something to mitigate, even in the very short period, I think 2 or 3 years that Zelaya was in office, because he certainly wasn't in power. But getting back to Guatemala and Otto Perez Molina, what's happened is that Otto Perez Molina has presented himself to the courts. I think he's actually going to be transferred to prison.
Whoa.
Which is unprecedented. I mean, his vice president, Roxana Baldanetti, I think her name is, I've forgotten, And his vice president is already in jail. And the scandal has come about as a result of a multi-million dollar corruption to do with manipulation of Guatemala's customs system, of which Baldetti and Perez Molina are alleged to have been the intellectual authors and beneficiaries. But and apparently a whole rake of lower down officials, many of them associated with the army, because in Guatemala the military has massive business interests.
Right, it's institutionalized. Yeah.
So and it's from the outside it looks like an internal spat between people in the corrupt Guatemalan elites who were squeezed out of the benefits of corruption, because look at the person who's taken over the presidency, this guy Alejandro Maldonado Aguirre. I mean, he's a machine politician if ever there was one, you know, and he's right out of the Guatemalan political elite, and it's very difficult for an outsider to believe that Maldonado is cleaner than somebody like Perez Molina, you know. It's just,
let me speculate on this for a minute. You know, you mentioned that it has to do with customs, I assume, with duties and okay. So what you're doing is making illicit deals. I don't even know if they're illegal, because you do have a legal system inherited from decades of military dictatorships. So who knows what the state of the law is there? But
right.
But in any event, illicit deals with these trading people, these trading partners, rather than the trading partners that the former elite had. Now, if he's been favoring integration, that means, for example, that maybe he's been making some scratch on some deals with Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua, etc., instead of with the United States. And that maybe was driving the battle, because the guys who were getting money from the United States aren't getting it anymore because they're not trading as much with them. Maybe that's behind it.
Yeah, and that you may well be right, because the whole idea that the United States authorities have any moral authority to talk about corruption anywhere, let alone in Central America, where they promoted it and benefited from it in so many ways for so long.
Yeah, on trade policy, the joke is that if you want to smuggle a nuclear weapon into the United States, for example, bury it in a shipping container full of cocaine.
Right, okay. So and just look at the corruption that is so rampant in the United States financial system, in the mortgage system, in the way companies are now legally allowed to engage in trading in their own shares.
Right.
And it's for the United States to kind of wag its finger at anybody is, as you say, a joke. So what does it mean in regional terms? It'll be interesting to see what it means in regional terms. It may mean that Guatemala will tend to drag its feet more in terms of regional integration within the Central American integration system. We'll see. But there's so many strange things about these events. For example, massive demonstrations, supposedly anti-corruption, against the Otto Perez Molina government, paralleling similar demonstrations in Honduras against the corruption of Juan Orlando Hernandez, the president there. And minimal levels of police repression, zero police repression, it's such a contrast with what happened 2010 in Honduras, where the police were absolutely vicious repressing political demonstrations against the government resulting from the coup. And so why is that? Why is there no police repression of these demonstrations? Obviously, because the power elites in Guatemala are driving those demonstrations in many ways. And then you have this, as the U.S. official pointed out in the clip that you played, the elections on Sunday. So what you've got is, what was that all about? Why suddenly go through this very dramatic process of hauling the incumbent president off to jail in the very last week of his presidency.
Right, I know. It's amazing.
But what is that all about? It's very clearly not about any kind of real democratic process, and that's another comment that you see constantly in articles commenting on the events in Guatemala, that this move against Perez Molina changes nothing in terms of the corrupt political establishment in Guatemala.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.